So today we are talking about how growth stage founders can effectively steer towards building a sustainable business. And I'm so pleased to have David Peterson, who is known as the optimization coach, with me today. And so David actually assists growth stage companies in 2xing their revenue growth to achieve their 10x goal. So he helps companies become much more appealing to investors, or if they choose, achieve their status as a successful founder-owned business. So welcome to Tech Uncensored. Hi, everyone. My name is Hesse Jones. At this juncture, early stage founders are generating revenue, and they may at this stage also aim to actually raise a successful series round A, but they have to also focus on revenue quality. They are selling a vision of the future, and they're emphasizing some of the key qualities that investors want to buy into. And so they have to construct this compelling narrative that justifies whether or not their idea is sound. So they not only need to understand the network effects as they grow, but the market receptivity, and more importantly, how the founders of their teams actually respond to each one of these things is going to be crucial. So when founders are growing their business, they'll also run into challenges when it comes to scaling. They'll start to incur costs to support the growth of their company. And so de-risking some of these challenges as they grow lays some solid groundwork for the future of the company. So here are some of the questions that startups must ask themselves as they grow. Do they truly understand the effort required to make an idea profitable? So this is not necessarily just about revenue. This is about making sure that they have the cash flow to sustain their business. How motivated are they to get out of their own way and do what's right for the business? What impact will their decisions have on the culture of the business as they grow, or if they have to downsize at some point in the future? And are the goals that they've articulated at the 5 and 10 year mark, are they achievable? So remember that early stage success isn't just about revenue. It's about building a strong foundation for sustainable growth. And David has experienced this in his own journey. And nurturing a company to actually create some kind of enduring organization is his sweet spot. And he offers some great advice. So I welcome David to the show today.
Thanks, Hesse. Thanks for having me.
No problem. So let's start with you and your background. You tell me about your startup journey, where it all began, and how you actually came to this point in being an advisor and coach for startup companies.
All right. I think I did a lot of different things, even in my much younger years. I actually built a password-free program back in the early 90s. And this was back in Dubai, and I went to pitch it, and people were like, "What do you mean no passwords? That's not secure. Passwords are very secure." And I'm like, "No,
the
you
know, time.
Way." I realized that I was all way ahead of my time. It was hilarious. I'm like, "You can't hack this. There's no password here." And there's like, "No, it was just bizarre." So that kind of went, I guess wrong time, wrong place, right? So that's one of the things I learned that early on. Then I really liked, computers, and the hardware was, was really evolving, and there was new stuff happening. I got into building computers for people, selling it to different individuals, providing support. So I sort of expanded there as a young entrepreneur selling computers and tech support. So that's how it actually all started. Then later on, I went, because I was in the tech support space when I was in Canada, I went to independent tech shops. This was prior to, the Best Buys and the Future Shops that existed that were sort of eating up most of those independent businesses that were providing tech support. So I built an app to help them get customers and go through that, but, not realizing where the bigger markets were playing. So I think that's something I learned during that journey. It's like, yes, that works. It's helping them. But at the end of the day, bigger players that are impacting their ability to business. And so therefore, it's not a sustainable growth model for myself as a business. Then later on, I actually develop, back to the whole password thing, but an identity management system that could use for payments, a very secure way to prevent fraud and those various aspects. That is when I actually joined Altitude back in the heyday, early on, part of Mars as well, and went all the way up to Techstars for Seattle. And the biggest challenge that I encountered there was basically where I had to drop out was it needed a 6-month commitment where I had to, just to get at the time, just starting a new family. And I had to pay not only for my own family, but the developers that were there to come with me. So that was not having the finances at that time was something where I learned like, okay, you really have to have a budget to keep the idea going and be able to grab certain opportunities that come your way if you need it. That was one part. And the other part that I learned from that one was I should have patented it because that is what Apple Pay is today. So if I had built that, we'd be talking about a whole different story.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. 2020 vision, right? And after the fact, that's amazing. So you've done this before. And so you understand the pitfalls of what, a lot of the startups today go through. So when you first talk to a startup founder, what are the first things that you want to learn about them to determine whether or not you could help them?
Well, I think going through all of that and now, like for me, being in business in Canada for the last 18 years, I think that has given me lots of different views and aspects, including the North American culture. And then if you're working internationally, how that all works. To me, the first thing is, where do they see themselves, right? Like 5, 10, 15, even 20 years from now. Aspects of, why are they in the business? Are they looking to sell it, build it, grow? Because that's exciting for a lot of people. Build a business, grow it, make money, build another business. And that's the exciting aspect for some founders. For other founders, it's like, okay, I want to live a life where I want to travel the world. I want to see different things. I want to be on a beach. I want to work for a couple of hours and then get back into the business, but I don't want to be chained to my business. So it's more like, is this an early retirement kind of vehicle business model that you're trying to build? That's one aspect of it. The other thing is it a legacy? Because some people want to build a legacy that they want to say, okay, I want this to fund me all the way through. I want to give it to my children so that they have a source of revenue. They can grow, they can take what they want with it and build it. So those are all the key aspects that's kind of decide or create a strategy of how to build a business. Because do you then need investors? Because if you're selling it off, yes, you need to build it where investors are like, oh yeah, there's money in this. I want to invest in it. And if you're doing it for other reasons, then do you need investor support or do you want to run it and, own a business privately owned as a founder, right? Have that as a success story.
It'd be interesting to see when, let's say you decide to take on that founder, if you had asked them the same question, let's say 5 years or even 2 years into a relationship, whether or not his answer changes. Have you done that?
I did. And actually, it does. What I've seen for most founders, as they start building a more profitable business, they go from, I just wanted to make money to, I want to get some investors. And I may want to say, hold on, this is generating enough money that why do I need an investor? So like there's a shift saying, if this is sustainable, and this is where it becomes very interesting, where it's sustainable, why do I need a founder? To, okay, let me see how much I can grow it. And then, okay, I do want to sit on a beach. Like some of them like, yeah, I do want to sit on a beach. I don't want to own it, but I want to be like the chairperson of the organization. I just want to be a shareholder and getting the returns this and coming and seeing what the business is doing. And therefore, as long as it's going the right way, I can hand it off to my family if they want it, or, later if I want to sell it, it opens doors and opportunities or different ways of doing business, or even the aspect of, I may want to start another business using the funds from this business, right? So there's a lot of opportunities in terms of ideas that, I see it as a founder, you never really stop with one great idea, right? There's always other ideas that just keep flowing.
Absolutely. Okay, so you have a mantra and you say everything is a project. And so as companies grow, like what does this mean in terms of how a company actually manages all their stuff?
Well, yeah, I mean, to me, everything I say everything's a project because the reality is everything is a project because there's two main things that I look at. The first one being there's a time-bound activity for something to happen. It's going to start here. It needs to finish by here. And there's always a budget. As much as people say, okay, if the moment you don't know how much I want to spend on it, you got to figure out how much you really want to spend on it and what's your reserves. Because costs really dictate what you can build. And why is it want to take that project approach is primarily because we need a plan. We need to know, okay, what do we need to do to get to where we need to get to? What's the cost for it? What's the real timeline for this? Would that work with all the other aspects that's happening within the business and, you know, all the other projects that have been kicked off? Maybe it's marketing, maybe it's a sales, maybe it's hiring, right? Maybe it's a new developer. Maybe it's the upgrade of the platform from one version to another version. It's a feature upgrade. Everything has a cost. Everything takes time. And projects, the primary purpose of projects is working with people. A lot of everything, or almost everything that needs to be developed or created requires a person to interact. And that's the key part, whether it's your customer or, you know, even building traction, right?
So it's not only in product development, you're saying to use some of those, the key approaches in actually, let's say, set up your accounting system, for example, right?
100%. Exactly. Because like, it's like, okay, what accounting system do I want? What's the benefits of this? Like, it is a project where if you go to somebody and say, okay, I want this, they'll go through that process. Here's the evaluations. Here are the different products. You go through a discovery phase. Then you go through, okay, let me plan out. Okay, once I select the tool, what's my implementation phase? Who do I need to integrate? Are there integrations that I need? Is it with the banking system, with the accountant, with my existing, maybe you have a SaaS-based app, for example, is it going to integrate with that? How do I streamline and I want to say like optimize that process so that if you start it off early enough, what ends up happening is you don't end up being resource heavy. And that's where most organizations kind of feel because the most expensive cost is people. And you want to get the right people to make sure that, you know, you've got the systems doing the heavy lifting and the people are providing you with that knowledge, that insight, that ability to make it even better because, you know, that's why we have machines.
It's interesting that you're talking about this kind of approach because everybody talks about how founders in the beginning have to be nimble. And hey, if I decide that I'm going to use that specific application, I'm just going to buy it today. But what you're saying is that if you don't do your homework, then you may realize that down the road there could be a potential integration, you know, obstacle that you run into with that specific app that may not necessarily be, I don't know, adaptable or configurable to your existing organization. So doing your homework saves a lot of time and money later on.
100%. Because whether it's the founder that's doing a lot of, like if a founder is, let's say a founder, you're being nimble, you're just starting up, right? And if you're saying, okay, I want to put this accounting app, you could spend, you know, upwards of 10, 15, 20 hours doing your research, putting it in, setting it up and what have you. And then as you start investing more time by putting more data into it, and as you're growing it, realizing where your company needs to be or where your 5-year plan is, this might've been a very quick fix, but once it grows after 2 years, then you try to work with another, you've outgrown it. What happens then? Now you got to spend money to move it from one system to another system. And then you create other problems that you're solving problems that retrospect, you're like, oh, I should have chosen that one. It would have saved $5 more, or maybe I should have held off, right? Like those kind of things, people retrospect and go back and then they feel like, because you didn't take a project approach to it, because you didn't evaluate the whole situation.
And I guess sometimes there are aspects that you can't anticipate, but as long as you, I'd say, not invest to the point that it's almost more expensive to make the changeover later on, I think that's key.
100%. Things need you have to look at products and services and organizations and vendors and partners that can support your growth, right? Because you want to grow into them. They're going to tap out at that point. Then you're looking at shifting. There's a cost to shift, right? And it disrupts business. But also sometimes it might be a great problem to have. It's like, oh, we've overgrown past what we expected. Like if that's what you're having, then you were supposed to be here 5 years, but you got there in year one or year two and a half. That's a fantastic problem to have, right? Because you were expecting to be there and you're here sooner. That's not really a problem. That's you've achieved something really great, because 5 years from now, you were supposed to make that shift, right? So to me, those aren't problems. Those are actually great opportunities to grow further.
Okay. So let's talk about, like, one of the questions that I put up in the abstract as I talked about this was, do founders truly understand the effort to make an idea profitable? Because as you know, when you start to grow, it, you know, revenue is king, right? And revenue to show the investors that you have an idea that's actually worth investing in. But at some point in time, profit becomes more king than revenue. Can you explain when that happens and when a founder needs to understand that specific signal?
That's in some ways a touchy topic, because it brings about the Excel sheet. Like, I've been a founder, I've been there. You come up with a brilliant idea, you're already sold into it, right? You believe it's going to make, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. And then you create, you go to Excel and you stop putting all the numbers and you're like, wow, I could get this and this. And you've created this evidence now of numbers to justify how this is like 100% profitable, is going to make a lot of money. What ends up happening is that the reality is between making the first sale, the second, the third, and, you know, basically doubling your user base from 1 to 2, 2 to 4, 4 to 8, 8 to 16 and so forth. That's your traction model. And traction is basically the key, what everybody looks for, right? And as a founder, the traction and the rate of traction and the pace of how your growth is will tell you how much of a growth you can sustain. Because if it's a very long period to, you know, double, let's say, you know, you've got from one customer, it takes you another 2 months to get the second customer. There's cost that you're having to one, support the customer, and to just BAU, business as usual, keep the lights on in your company. Those costs need to be factored in. And that's where you have to develop different strategies to say, here's my cost of running my business. Here's the cost of, you know, acquisition for a client. Here's the cost to support the client, which I have. How fast do I need to really grow to make that model successful? Because if you can't sustain the business, you're going to be putting a lot of money to keep it alive. But eventually, if that gap is too wide, that's when, you know, startups, you know, why do startups fail? Is they just don't have enough money to take them across the journey, to cross the chasm, so to speak, and get to the other side. And that's why sometimes if you do a project plan, and this is why I always go by the factor part, the project plan will tell you, do you have the money to get you across this side? Like, then, you know, I want to drive from one end of the country to the other. Gas stations, do you have the money for gas? Sometimes you'd be like, you know, I've got the first tank of gas, I'm going to go. And then it's like, okay, now you're stuck. But, you know, and you're missing opportunities, because time is opportunity, right? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of my approach to that.
Now, if you take that scenario and compare a SaaS business to, let's say, a hardware business, it's very different. Obviously, SaaS is much, much easier to plan for in some cases, right? But you can explain why you don't agree with that. But for hardware, it's much harder because it's a physical product. It takes time to develop. And so trying to forecast demand and also taking consideration how long it takes to build that thing and your reliance on, let's say, the manufacturer to be able to get it to you within a specific amount of time, that's hard.
Yeah. So to me, it's the risk, right? So I view it as both need development. And if you're building a SaaS-based product, you're building it. The risk for the SaaS is same for the hardware. You always have this upfront part. You're sort of testing the market, and it's more cost effective as a SaaS business versus a hardware business. But in the hardware business, what you're running is the risk of, what are my, you know, like, I'm building. What else is somebody else building that we don't know about, right? So you've got that, you've got manufacturing, you got market opportunity, you have a window that tends to kind of shrink really fast as things move at a different pace. what are the other technology disruptors that you couldn't factor in or are aware of? So all of those things need to be, you know, if you take the project plan approach again, is like, there's a whole risk strategy. You do risk mitigation. How do I mitigate for these risks? Because do I need to order equipment? Do I just choose to have a smaller inventory? Those things help the founder realize, okay, I'm going to take this approach, or I'm going to take that approach. That will solve that problem. That will solve that problem. Because at the end of the day, all these risks are problems that a business has to have. And the problem that it creates is the financial problem.
Mm-hmm.
Most startups are self-funded. They do get some investors, and those investors normally are family and friends. So I don't really call them as investors. Those are people that believe in the person more than the product that they're building. Investors look at what's the product, is their ability to market it, and is the founder, you know, confident enough that they can sell it? Because then they're buying the person at the end of the day, right? They're investing in the person, but they're also investing in a product as the ability to make money.
Okay. So you coach companies, both the founder and their teams. So as they grow, you know, the founder himself has to balance for growth, but also he's starting to wear a couple of hats. Because now his team is going from, let's say, 2 people to now like 5 and then 10. So what do you counsel the founder at this stage, especially when it comes to starting to develop a culture that he wants people to work in?
Yeah, in all honesty, it is tough, right? It's tough for founders because most founders didn't get the opportunity to run their own business, right? They haven't run a business. They didn't fail. They didn't get the opportunity to fail. They've got a brilliant idea that they're working with that they don't want to fail, right? So they're by default, under a lot of pressure. Some of them never even had the opportunities to manage large teams or people, motivate them, hire people, right? That wasn't something that they've ever had the opportunity to do. Now they're put into a position where they're become the CEO of a company, probably never wore a CEO hat before in their life. And now they're the CEO, and now they're dealing with marketing, sales, HR, the lawyers, contracts, vendors, procurement, right? All sorts of different things. It is just, you talk about drinking from a fire hose, like they're just being bombarded by somebody hold the fire hose because now, it's the company. And the shift is, before it was a person and an idea, now it's the company that owns the idea, right? So once the company owns the idea, the CEO's job is to lead the company. And it's no longer, if I'm the CEO, it's no longer my idea, the company's idea. I sold it the moment I incorporated it, right? The company owns that idea. They own that IP now. I did a trade. I'm running that company to become more successful, to sell that idea, that IP that company owned and has bought from me and make that successful. So that transition, that letting go of that, let's call it, your baby or the idea that you had and letting the company run it and running a company with the CEO mindset.
Mm-hmm. You actually touched on like my next point about what this CEO mindset looks like. Because as you say, they haven't done this before. So what is the critical realization that they come to, or when do they come to it, where they realize that this is not a hobby anymore, that this is something that could actually sustain and make money? And at what point do I have to just get out of my own way for the benefit of the company?
Absolutely. And that comes down to what was their first intention, right? If their intention was, I want to do this because it just brings me personal pleasure. It's a hobby. I love it. If I'm making some money out of it, great. It goes into my little kitty and, I have some more money to invest in my hobby. And then you're developing that into a company. It's a very different mindset. It's a different growth pattern. It's a different shift from what a person has. There's a lot of passion involved in it. It isn't about making money. It's about providing service to somebody that can benefit from their own passion they're enjoying by themselves. When someone comes in as a founder as well, where here's something that I want to build, I want to create, but the purpose of it is to make money. The purpose of any business is to make money. If it's not making money, then that's a hobby. And that's the biggest differentiator that I want to point out is if it's not making money, it's a hobby that you're investing in. Yeah, it might, you know, it's nice to do and nice to have, but the intention is important. And a lot of people may have the intention of making money, but not a lot of ideas make money, right? Mm-hmm. It could be like, you know, me personally as well, could be just, you know, market opportunity. Timing might be off. It might be a brilliant idea that just wait a year, you need to build it and wait for it. Or it just might be that there's just not enough consumers there to help you grow and sustain the business. Because it needs, you know, you need a lot of money to grow the business to get to one client. And then, you know, if you look at the bell curve or however you want to look at it, but there's a sustainment aspect of it. And is there enough customers that can keep engaging it or stay on long enough for you to sustain that business, for you to look at having your next idea or, you know, selling it or moving it and doing whatever you want to do with it?
So at what point does a founder or do you see in instances where the founder just throws up his hands and he says, that's it, I can't do it anymore? Because obviously the journey is hard and they may not necessarily get that their funding and they're bootstrapping to the point where they say, okay, I can't throw any more money at this. Like when does that typically happen and how do you counsel them on it?
Well, that normally happens towards the end, and which is normally the sad part, because they've sort of burnt a lot and they're coming for help at the point where it's very difficult to provide help unless there's financial funds to support the fix, right? Because everything costs money. And that's why if you look at the project aspect of it, there's time. So it's going to take time to fix it, but it's going to require money to fix it. I always tell people, and that's what they learn, sometimes through the hard way, you know, even myself, you learn by getting people on early enough, getting the right counsel, understanding the difference between a coach and an advisor, because the advisor is going to tell you based on their experiences or no knowledge of other people that have gone through it. The coach kind of works with the individual's strengths, right? So it's like, what do you have as your strength? How do I work with what you've got so that you can then take it and grow your company? Right? Because that's the slight difference. To me, it's always getting people on early enough, because the earlier you get it, you prevent yourself from getting in that situation. Sometimes you can work with people to say, okay, fine. Yeah. Okay. You don't know what to do. Let's create a plan. Let's see what other options are out there. Maybe some other types of investors, maybe it's repackaging it, maybe it's bringing it down slower to something that's, you know, more manageable, more cost effective in terms of what you can sustain to keep it alive, to end up with the dream or the idea that you initially had, you know, you had. And the journey might be different, but if the end goal is still achievable, then I think that's part of the process, right?
You're almost giving founders the tools in a way to stop them from making the wrong decisions. And I think from what I hear you say is that if I'm going to do this right, then I can't have this knee-jerk effect or in making some of these decisions. Because, for example, like hiring, right? You can hire your best friend. Your mom says, you know what, can you give your brother a job? Get him started in your company. A lot of those decisions earlier on don't have a huge impact, but may have a bigger impact later on in the company. So you're trying to get them started early to be more, I would say, mature about how they make decisions. Is that fair?
Yeah, it's understanding the consequences of decisions. Like every decision you make has a consequence. What are those consequences? Are those consequences that are good consequences? Are those consequences that, oh crap, I don't really want to have those? Because sometimes you don't think about it, right? Like everybody starts off with good intentions. No one really starts mm-hmm. off like, you know, hiring family, whatever it is. Like, it's a good intention. There's a person that wants to get in, or I'm giving them some, you know, a percentage of the equity. All that stuff works out because it's like, okay, I'm bringing somebody in. But then you go to an investor and the investor's like, okay, I want to buy X. These people own that much amount of equity. What are they doing? What are they contributing? But that person can't get me to where. So it's like, well, I'm only getting this portion in, and you want X millions of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars. but no one's put in the same dollar value or, you know, even sweat equity wise, they don't have that. It creates problems in the financial model, because at the end of the day, if you look at any business, and I say, if anyone's invested in a stock or an equity fund or whatever it is, you're only going to invest in a company that's making money. No one's going to invest in a company that's not making money. No one would say, hey, that company is struggling, might reach bankruptcy, let me buy a lot of their stock, right? You're not going to do that, right? So it's the same thing. Like, you're, as a company, are you building a company that people are going to say, hey, you're making money, I'm going to invest in you, and this is how I'm, you know, and this is where you structured it well enough that you can allow investment to come in if you need it. Maybe it's private funding, maybe like there's so many options. There's options for everything. It all comes down to, what do you want your company to be, you know, 5-10 years? Is it something for your retirement, something as a legacy, something that you want to sell? Those things always anchor the decisions that you're making, because the goal for, you know, the founders, I wanted that because I want to sell it on the beach. I wanted that because I want to get money in and retire early. I want that because I want to sell it off, you know, after about 10 years, if I reach this dollar value, that's when I want to exit. Those are goals that you build within the company as part of the strategy for the founder, because that's really how you play the game, because you're playing a different game, right? And that's the most important thing, is that, which game are you playing, right? Because sometimes people say, okay, I'm going to start the journey and I'll figure out what I'm going to do. But there's like, you've changed the game that you've played every time. You've changed your strategy, your customer base, the approaches, everything changes, right? Everything is anchored to which game you're playing.
Okay. So I don't know if you have an example of a company that you've done business with for a while and you counsel them and they actually take your advice and they're ready to fly on their own. Like, how would you define or determine what characteristics they actually have that acknowledge, it's a whether or not in themselves or within their business, that they don't need you anymore?
So to me, it's when they need to talk less and less, right? When they have less problems that they need to resolve, when they've got the support system within the organization and the people that can solve the problems that they need, right? So it's no longer, oh, we need to solve for these problems. I've got the team, I've got the people that can do it. Okay, I've got an HR issue. I've got the right person in HR. They can handle that. I don't need to do that. I need to increase the revenue. I've got the right sales person heading sales on the sales team. They'll increase the revenue. And if they need support for marketing, I got marketing, business development, lawyers. Okay, I already have lawyers. I know it. And the people within the company know who to talk to get that done. I know I don't need to be involved in it. I can, you know, as a CEO, I can lead without being involved in the day-to-day businesses of the organization. And there are people that look at the day-to-day, and I'm there to keep them to their North Star and say, okay, this is still where we're going. How are we going towards that? And you're tracking their ability and keeping everybody in sync towards achieving that North Star goal. So that's when they really, that is a different kind of aspect of it. It's people management kind of coaching versus, you know, business coaching.
Are there companies that you have that you're particularly proud of in helping them achieve what they've set out to achieve?
I am. There are a few that have been, you know, that I'm very happy with what they've managed to achieve in such a short period of time. And they've helped me even refine my model, right? Because I do have a specific business model that I use for companies, and working with the different players that helps me optimization, but it helped me keep refining continuous improvement and optimize that model even further for other startups I want to come up on, do the same thing. And it's a win-win for everybody. Everyone's benefiting through that whole process, and it's great.
So if you were to have just like one piece of advice for founders in the growth stage and how they could help, I don't know, achieve this mindset that you speak of, what should they be open to, or what should they look for?
Do you have a plan? And what does that plan look like? Is it written down? Because that's the first thing. If you don't have that, you don't have that written down, you're kind of, I want to say, you're winging it, And then you have no way to measure your success and you have no way to figure out when you need to pivot or what do you need to go to do to get back on track, right? So it just comes down, do you have a plan? And because if you have a plan, you'll have a budget and you'll know how that's all going to work out. I think if they have that, they're 80% successful and then it's 20% of the effort. Like, cause that's really all it is. A lot of the work is really a mind exercise that needs to be done. And once you do that 80% of the mind exercise, then the 20% is the effort that they just need to be successful versus putting 80% of the effort and then saying, oh crap, I need to read.
Yeah. It's amazing. Everything that you talked about, it's like, oh my God, I remember doing all that and also feeling the pain of having to go to make some of those tough decisions. Right. So I thank you for spending the time with me today, David.
Oh, thanks for having me. It was a lovely conversation.
It was. And so that's all we have time for today. And if our audience, if any of you have topics that you want us to cover, please don't hesitate to email us at communications@altitudeaccelerator.ca. Tech Uncensored is powered by Altitude Accelerator and it's produced by Bloomex and Transistor Radio. My name is Tessie Jones, and until next time, have fun and stay safe.
Tech Uncensored, an Altitude Accelerator podcast, does not constitute a recommendation for any organization, product, or service. It's produced and distributed by Bloomex. For more Tech Uncensored content, subscribe where you get your podcasts and visit bloomex.io to join us on Discord.